Welcome to the Imagination Redeemed podcast, a podcast of the Anselm Society. I'm Brian Brown. At last year's Imagination Redeemed conference, I hosted a conversation with Amy Lee and my wife, Christina, about the role of gardening in cultivating us to share in God's story. Each of these two remarkable people has invested both as a person and as a parent in cultivating a garden, and each had inspiring stories to share about how that has taught them to live more as humans were made to. We thought the conversation built beautifully on Gracie Olmsted's essay in our last episode, giving some tangible, practical material to help apply Gracie's concepts in real-life situations. So we wanted to share it with you. And a reminder, there are still a few tickets available for this year's Imagination Redeemed conference at the end of September. You can get yours at imaginationredeemed.com. So to get started, one of the things that the three of us have been talking about a lot is the relationship between garden and story, garden as a narrative, as this place where that sort of has its own story over time, but also that allows humans to live out and interact with a story over time. I want to define some terms, but I want to just get this backstory first. I'd love to hear from each of you a little bit of the story of your garden. You want to start, Amy?
Sure. I had a black thumb. I still do when it comes to indoor plants. It's really tragic. but I mean, you can see some of it going on in the slideshow above our heads. But for us, we started gardening really about 5-6 years ago when we moved to our new house. So we inherited this bit of land, so to speak. And I really have to blame Lancia and Lanier Ivester and Tasha Tudor and Monty Don for making me think that this was something that we could do, and that this, not just something that we could do, but that gardening could be part of making life more beautiful, being more intentional about making beauty in our lives. So that's pretty much how we got started. And I don't know if you can see from the slideshow, it'll probably come around again, but when we moved into our house, it had been a dog run, the backyard, and it was overgrown with grass, and then there were patches of bareness. And then as we were thinking about what to do that first year, we had one sunflower come up, and I still think it was from these bagel seeds that I just happened to toss out for the birds. But it may have been one of the squirrels that came by and just planted it there. But we had this single sunflower come up, and even just that single thing being there was something to watch. Like, I watched a little songbird come and alight on it one day, and it just went, it hung on the top of it with its feet and then went upside down into the seeds to eat it. And I just remember being absolutely fascinated by that, but that was kind of how we got started.
Yeah, wow.
And your garden story?
My garden now?
No, the story of your garden, the narrative.
The narrative, okay.
Where is it, and what was it, and what is it now?
Okay.
From A to Z.
Yes. So, I don't know if you can hear me. My garden now, so we lived in an apartment complex for the first 10 years of our marriage, and I had gardened a lot with my dad growing up, and there was something in the earth that just called me then. It's kind of intangible, but I knew it was there, and I was like, oh, and someday I'll have my own garden. The interesting thing is, out of nowhere, last year we were given, we were alerted to a plot of land in another apartment. But it was a house apartment, so we actually got the first floor. But apartments are very rarely taken care of. People just know it's not theirs, it's not their property. They don't have ownership, so they don't have to take care of it. So the land in our backyard was just overgrown, wild weeds, thorns, thistles, like, it's old stumps of trees. I mean, you name it. Now I do like a charming old stump. I do, it's like a fairyland. But anyway, I saw it and I thought, this is my chance. Like, I might not be in this apartment forever, but now is my chance to beautify something. So we began. There was some planter's boxes. I had to decide what to do with those. There was some landscaping I decided to dig into the ground. I've just been learning a lot about plants surviving and dying and thriving and
in Colorado.
It's a totally different game. Yes. So it's a work in progress. Still learning things. There was a plant that I was sure was going to survive, the bleeding heart. It had all the perfect qualities of, you know, where it was supposed to thrive. Died completely. Root rot, like, who knows why. So anyway, still learning, but yeah.
And as I'm slowly learning, a garden is not a, as it turns out, a project that you start and finish.
No. Nope.
So we've already mentioned a few terms, and this is the point where I want to pause and define some terms. And so there's three I want to make sure everybody's on the same page about. This is less of a definition of terms, but more of a concept. But question of why gardens, like not why nature, why gardens? Why not just let God's creation do its thing? You have wild things over here. You have untended things over here. A lot of us live in developments where they bulldozed all of nature and put it in a bunch of asphalt, and there's definitely nothing God did there. So that's question number one. Why gardens? Why not just do your thing in your house and then go to a park sometimes?
Should we answer one now?
Yeah, start there.
Okay.
I'll add layers.
Add layers. I don't know. I think there are like a million answers to that question. You can kind of go many, many places theologically. But the one that's really struck me, it's in the last year, has been the idea that we were placed in a garden to begin with. And I think, you know, whether or not you take the whole Genesis story literally or figuratively, there is something to that that you cannot ignore. And so the cultural mandate, the idea of the naming of things that Adam was given, bringing life, stewarding it, you know, bringing creation under the rule of man, I think there's something that we can't just say, oh, let nature do its thing. We have to love it. We have to hold it gently. We have to nurture it and take care of it. I think that's part of God's intention was that we're for us to kind of subcreate with Him and grow with Him and learn to be like Him in loving something that is beautiful. So I don't know. I think that's the one that's really been coming to me as I've been cultivating this little plot of land is really following in the footsteps of the call to life and to nurture and to love. So.
I love that. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that there's so much that we're called to give into, called to participate in by way of gardening. Mm-hmm. And then also the garden itself in the process, it does something to us. Mm-hmm. Like there is something in the cyclical nature of the seasons. Mm-hmm. There's something in seeing something die and resurrect before your eyes that brings kind of an embodied, tangible truth to the truths that we already know. Mm-hmm. And so I think the way that works out in reality can look different. Like there are gardens that people cultivate to bring back the natural surroundings or the plants of mm-hmm. a given area, and
right.
there are gardens that are cultivated
like
for pollinators.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I find it particularly exciting. I think it hit me last year that I was looking out at the yard, and our garden isn't very big, and I am by no stretch of the imagination a master gardener. It's very much a learning process as we're going, and that's why we were kind of so glad to do this session, because it's not an expert session. We get to tell stories of what God has done. But I was looking out at our yard and thinking that this may be the first time that this particular plot of land has ever been cultivated to any extent. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of an exciting thought that, you know, mm-hmm. as much as we lament developers coming through and mowing down everything, it was prairie out there. Certainly there might have been native tribes coming through, but like to stay and to dwell and to bring things up. And that was kind of exciting to think about, well, maybe we are the first to participate with this particular plot of land mm-hmm. in God's kingdom work here. Mm-hmm. So Yeah, I agree with Christina. There's like a million ways to answer that question.
Well, there's a pretty significant distinction, though, between your situation and yours in that respect, though, because you had a blank slate. You had no one's ever done this before in this place. And that's the opposite of what we found in our house.
Did you all have things set? You had some beds already in place when you moved in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And 12-foot lilacs all around the edges that nobody had trimmed in.
However long.
Gone wild.
Yeah. I want to answer that question a little more, too, because I had a thought as we were talking. Mm-hmm. The other reason I think a garden and what cultivating in a garden can teach us is kind of the embodiment of the resurrection, right? I think part of what I love about gardening, and has astounded me about gardening, is that I'm not the ultimate controller of what these plants do. Like, they will die and they will resurrect themselves in some ways, and things that you thought were dead will come back and surprise you the next year. And I think understanding that life and death is not quite in our hands is humbling, right? And I think for me, and we might talk about this later, but I think that can be healing, right? And it can be a proof that resurrection is real, and it's powered by God and nothing else. Of course, we can foster life, we can plant seeds, you know, we can grow them and nurture them, and we can kill them, right, if we don't take care of them, you know. But they have a life of their own, and we need to respect that, I think. They are part of the created order, what God designed. And so it's the resurrection, I think, is a good call to see in a garden. Yeah.
Let's tug on that thread, because it seems like we can be more or less intentional about that. I mean, there are so many trees throughout my life that I've walked past thousands of times. And sometimes you stop and you think how beautiful this is. And sometimes you just sort of smile at it as you go past. But you can also take it for granted to a pretty significant extent. And you found ways to be very intentional about that cycle of death and resurrection with our kids. I'm thinking particularly of your seedlings experience. Tell that story.
Okay. That's a fun one. It's still. So, I mean, part of the background, I think, in this too, that I should mention, my mom passed away just a little over a year ago, and it was right after we had moved into this house. It was right after I was so excited to show her my garden, to say, Mom, look what I can do now. So in so many ways, this ground, this patch of earth has been healing. I have a t-shirt, it's probably again in one of these pictures somewhere, that says gardening is my therapy, which has kind of been accurate this last year. I think it's, you know, I believe in therapy. It's all wonderful. Real therapy. It's good. But there's something healing in the earth, I think, and it's tangible and it's physical and it really touches us. Its roots kind of from the earth grow into us and heal us. So that's a little background for that, because I write for a magazine, Amy does too, The Cultivating Project. It's about how do you cultivate goodness, truth, and beauty into your life. And I work for the Cultivating Kids branch on that magazine. And one of my teammates, my colleagues, said, well, what if, Christina, you write a couple liturgies about seeds for children? I was like, okay. That sounds fun. Why not? I mean, I was raised Anglican. I know what a liturgy is, right?
What is a liturgy?
Oh, gosh. Stop it. Stop it. You had to go there. Thanks for that. But a liturgy, you know, I love the whole term liturgical living, because it means an ordered way, someplace to live into something you know to be true by repetitive action, repetitive words, deeds, truths that you retell yourself and echo to remind yourself of what is real. Was that a good answer?
Yeah, you maybe. Totally ruined my attempt to
just dot me up.
Throw you a curveball there. Curve okay, ball. So keep going.
Well, where were we?
Liturgies. Yeah.
The liturgy of the seeds. Yes. So the idea was to make a liturgy or a prayer for the planting of a seed, for the sprouting of a seed, and for the dying of a seed. And so the idea was to raise your children into the act of doing this and saying a prayer over each cycle. So I decided to do it with my kids. I mean, I wrote the things. You have to kind of like practice what you preach, right? And there's some pictures up there. My two little kids, Edmund and Edith, and I, we took cups of seeds or cups of soil. We planted seeds. We prayed the prayer for the planting of the seed. And when the first sprouts showed, we prayed that for the sprouting of the seeds and the blessing over their growth. But inevitably, seeds die. And so they were a couple that never sprouted. And I was like, well, this is what these liturgies are for. So we had this little mini service where it was kind of off, top of my head. I was like, is this weird or is this real? but we took the little empty, dead cups of seeds that never sprouted. We took them into our backyard under the lilac bushes and we said the prayer and we dumped the cups of earth into the soil that was there. We spread it around and said, Lord, we trust that you will make life from this death. And it was really precious that my daughter was very into it. My son was just crying. Like he just was so sad. And there was something about the prayer. I mean, I was sad. There's something about the prayer that reminds us that even in the death of seeds, like there is life to come. And so anyway, this whole process was sort of healing for me even in the wake of my mother's death and just trying to understand what resurrection is and what it means, how death is out of our control in so many ways, but that there is promise, there is redemption. Even the soil carries the very act of life through death. So, yeah.
And Edmund in particular has,
my son Edmund, yeah.
Yeah, has, it's fascinating the way that the difference between how he relates to our house and how he relates to our yard and how the latter is starting to shape the former. Because children instinctively interact with the world as a static place. And that can be more or less depending on how many times you move and things like that. But they don't have quite that sense of time. And Edmund's been learning it through the experience of the garden. There's that stillness of time is becoming a sense of past and present and future with the garden. And it seems like there's more than one way that a garden can help you relate to time. In Edmund's case, a lot of it is that sense, not so much of eternity, but of this thing has been handed to me. It was here before me, and it's going to grow around me. And if I do my job right, it will be there after me. Your garden, Amy, is you've leaned into a different aspect of eternity with not just your garden, but your house and the Athelian metaphor that you've been using. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I can. Is anybody in the room familiar with The Lord of the Rings? Because that may make my explanation a little bit less detailed. By the way, I think the photos are alternating between our gardens, if that helps to contextualize them. But I, when nobody was looking, chose to name our house Ithilien House. And it's the region in Tolkien's Middle Earth that is like right at the front door of Mordor in the time of the Lord of the Rings. But it wasn't always that way. And even when it's abandoned to the enemy, I think Tolkien says, it had a disheveled dryad loveliness about it. And that was kind of like the state of our yard when we moved in. It was definitely disheveled and a dryad could have been living there, I don't know, from a former ghost of a tree. But when we moved in, that's the state of what it was. And as I was thinking about Tolkien and the whole myth of Middle Earth, I named it Athelion because I loved that it was a land kind of caught in between, like it had the evil on one side and the good and the homely on the other, but also it was in between in terms of time. So what happens is, and I hope I'm not spoiling it for anybody, but there's the War of the Ring. And then when that is over though, Athelion becomes, I think the nickname is the Garden of Gondor. It becomes a place of flourishing and it becomes a place of healing where, as some people who fought in the war need to recover, they go and they find a healing as they cultivate, as they bring green and growing things up through the earth. And so I liked that vision. I liked the thought of having a place that could be a place of healing and of restoration and just a little glimpse of the kind of restoration that is coming. And so that is the name of our house and our garden. And I'm very thankful for friends who indulge me in that by making signs and that I can hang in the window. And my husband's on board too. So
I'm
really
question.
Thankful. The kids are a little bit mystified because they haven't read Lord of the Rings yet, but they see enough paraphernalia around that they're like, is this from the Lord of the Rings, Mommy? I'm like, yes, yes, it is. So, yes. So I'll look forward to explaining that to them someday.
Well, I mean, talk about what you have explained, both of you, because what has the experience been like of going from nothing to something in your case, from something neglected to something tended in your case, and you both have small children that you've chosen to invite into this process with you. What's that been like? Would you go first?
Sure, with children. I don't think I had an agenda, which was why it's been such a fun discovery as we've been going along. But so my children have kind of grown up with the garden. I was looking at the early pictures and they're so tiny and one's like almost my height now. But I remember the first year, starting things from seed just seemed like a miracle. I remember starting the tray for me, and I had the plastic wrap over it according to the nursery's advice, and just watching them pop up through the soil to me was a miracle. And then a few months later, I noticed that my youngest climbed up to the kitchen table and she was going, pepper, tomato, marigold. Like she recognized these plants by their leaves. Mm-hmm. And so it's been kind of wondrous to see all of that coming about. Well, I think it was partly the excitement, too, that I had about it. Like, we're going to get to eat from these. And that was my one goal, to grow a really good tomato that first year. I failed miserably because it's Colorado. If you want to grow a decent tomato, often you'll have better luck with a cherry tomato because the rainfall is so varied here that you'll get cat facing, you'll get cracking and all of that. So we grow really good cherry tomatoes now. But that was my goal the first year, so we got really excited about that. And then as things started happening with the garden, and I should probably publicly apologize to my husband, because when we first moved in, I was like, this is my vision, we're gonna have a little winding path in the back of the garden, we're gonna grow flowers along it, and we'll have a vegetable garden off to the side, because it will be aesthetically pleasing, and because it'll just, you know, it's just so quaint how it's all laid out in my head. So he did it. I mean, we did it, but I mean, yeah, he really did the bulk of the work. Put down the path, planted the vegetable garden. By the end of that next fall, I found out as I was watching the sun, that particular area that I had marked out for the vegetable garden gets 2 hours of sun a day. So then I looked at him and I was like, I'm so sorry. I think we're gonna have to move it. So we have this running joke between us. I mean, you said, Brian, that gardening is not a work that ever finishes. That has just dawned on us in the past like year or two, because we're finding that the things that have benefited us from gardening, it's something that, it's the process. It's who you become and what you learn that you want to keep going. And every year is gonna be different. Every year brings different pests. Every year brings a different vegetable doing or flower doing well. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we've had to move things around. But in the process, I think just watching things happen in spite of us, because like you were saying, Christina, that it is something that you do in partnership with God. And I think about that, and I think about the structural principles, the scriptural principles about, you know, even Paul saying that he planted the seed, but Apollos watered it, and God gave the growth. Mm-hmm. And that's so true of the garden, that the most I can do is to make the conditions as optimal as possible. But the miracle of the thing actually breaking open and coming up and flourishing, to watch that every year, is just such an act of grace, I feel like, over and over again. Out of that, I think we've had family traditions that have been born out of that. Like when we first brought in our first tiny little harvest, I think it was maybe, you know, a couple of radishes and a tiny little bell pepper and a cherry tomato or something. No, it would have been too early for tomatoes. But when we brought in our first harvest, that thing seemed so momentous. We decided to do what we called a little feast of first fruits. So we sliced it up into like slivers, like paper thin slivers, because there's only so much to go around. And I got out, we had a hymn to go with it, and we had a little prayer to read together. And we just celebrated that first first feast of first fruits. And then the next year, though, the children remembered it. So they said, when are we going to do it again? And we were like, I said, when the first radish is ripe. And so, you know, and they were pulling up radishes. So some years we've waited until we actually have enough to share before we do that. We've done that. And sorry, I don't mean to hog the conversation.
So it started out as the Feast of First Fruits. Yeah. Started out as more like the tapas bar of first fruits.
Yeah.
Then has grown from there.
It has grown from there. And then we also put in some raised beds, kind of based on the concept of Plumfield from Alcott's Little Men, where each child gets his own garden plot and they're allowed to grow anything. And each plot kind of reflects the character and person that comes to reflect the character and the personality of each child, because there's always the impatient one that like tries to pull things up by the roots to see how they're doing underneath the ground. You know? And then there are other children who want to just grow flowers, and others that want to grow herbs or thistles for the donkey. And so I was so charmed by that, I decided we're gonna have Plumfield plots. So the girls planted, and they get to plant every year what they want to plant in it. And then last year, especially for the pandemic, we did a thing where they would sell it to the kitchen. So we would pay them by the ounce, the going market rate. It wasn't very much. It was like 7-8 cents at a time, you know. And my husband would tease them and say, like, oh, I rounded up this time. And they would earn a little bit of money from that. But so we've just had little traditions and things birth out of really just the sense of wonder of watching things grow. And I think privately, I don't think this is a thing I do with the family, but at the end of every season, I always have a closing of the garden moment. Mm. Not where I clean things up, but where I just walk through and I realize things are dying down. Mm. And I realize autumn is right around the corner. And usually it's quiet weather in the garden at that time. And it's not a discipline in that I think that this is coming, it just happens. Mm. I go through there and I feel like I need to say thank you for all the little details that I'm seeing at that moment. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I did that just the other day, actually.
Did you really?
I did. I weeded I was probably one of the last times, and it was such a sacred thing.
It does feel sacred.
Yeah. Yeah. And then humbling. I find it very humbling. I find gardening very humbling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, why go to so much trouble? I mean, we sort of planted the seed last night.
Puns, I love puns. So good.
he says apologetically.
I say embrace it.
Fine. But this idea that we're not just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. That something about what we do now matters for eternity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but this whole placemaking thing, it's so temporary. It's such a hard fight. You have to fight so hard to get one little plant to survive, at least around here. And you're with a lot of the plants, you're going to come close to starting all over next year, depending on whether they're perennials or not. Gosh, you're probably not even going to live in that house forever. Why so much emphasis on this cultivation and creating a sense of place when it's not permanent? It's not like Glen Eyrie where, all right, built the schoolhouse, it's so cool, it's a castle, everyone's going to come here forever. Why?
Well, I have things to say, so you should go first.
I'm still processing them all, honestly. In a way, it's been interesting because gardening to me this year, I didn't experience this back in high school when I was gardening with my father, but being a mother and gardening is a completely different thing for me. I start to sort of feel almost like a mother to my plants, right? Every little bloom or death or like, oh, you're withering, you're wilting, like, let me give you some water, sweetheart, has just felt so tender and so life-giving, but hard, right? I think, I'm trying to remember where I was actually going with this. Why placemaking? I think I was going with the idea, and maybe this is part of me being a woman, right? In terms of like nurturing, right? And having that natural sort of instinct to foster life, perhaps. But there's something about placemaking, planting roots, that reminds you that you are rooted as well. We were also, I think it reminds us that we were exiled. You know, we were uprooted from the garden. We were pushed out. And so I think when we plant and when we garden and when we help things drive their roots into the ground, we remind ourselves that we are meant to be rooted, right? We are meant for a place. We are meant for a city. We are meant to flourish. We are rooted in Christ, as scripture says. So I think that's been really interesting for me as well. I love beauty. I love beautiful things. I mean, always have. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of patience for me to look at something uncultivated or ugly and be like, I just want to do something with that. Can I just plant a flower, please? Can I, take a rake, maybe? Pull some leaves, make a big pile?
If you just had a slightly better shade of green.
They are curses to this, yes. but I think just bringing beauty is nourishing. I think beautiful things. I think beauty, truth, goodness, God are so interwoven and interconnected that you can't separate them. And I do believe that gardening and bringing forth beauty will teach us more about God. I just think that's kind of...
Sorry, I said I had things to say, not because I have things to say, but like you baited me, and I feel like I need to be passionate in my defense of tending a garden.
Do this instinctively, but you also both explain it very well. So.
We do what instinctively?
Responding to.
Oh, thank you. I thought you meant being baited.
That's true. That's fair for me.
Why have a garden if I don't know what the person who's going to live in the house after us is going to do? If, I could die and, tomorrow, and then it goes untended. So many reasons. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this the other day and how we are called to engage in the building of the kingdom, right? That we are called to engage in the practices of feasting and of discipling and of relating to other people and building each other up and gardening and all of this as an outworking of that. And I was thinking about the fact that the world is going to be destroyed, because when people talk about redemption and restoration, like sometimes that gets left out inadvertently, that God is, that part of his design is to destroy this current earth. And it certainly is tending towards that end right now. We can see like just entropy, So why go about the work of building his kingdom here right now if the fullness of it is coming? And I think the thing that I keep circling back to is the eternal things that we're called to engage in right now are going to last for eternity. But the way that we engage in those eternal things are going to involve things that we grasp with our hands and we taste with our mouths and that we see with our eyes. And so if I am tending a garden, it's not just tending a garden. It's not just about, oh, heavens help us. It is not just about how many pounds of vegetables I'm going to produce out of a garden this year. It is about having, like, maybe without the garden in my life, I think I would not have developed a certain mode of seeing, of noticing certain things, and of just being drawn to worship and give thanks for the simple reason that they exist. And if I didn't have that space, I don't know that I would have a quiet sanctuary-like place. We do have a busy road near our house, and you can hear the car swooshing by. But to invite people into and to have conversations with them there, that is the kind of eternal work that is being done. Like when you have a person come into your garden and you talk with them and they feel safe enough to cry, that environment that was being provided for them, there is something different about that environment than meeting with them in a bus terminal, say. And all of the things, all the tools that we are using to engage in that work, we are building the eternal kingdom, and we are also having things changed within ourselves, like Nigel in his intermediary states or phases that he went through. And if that's where the work is being done, then how can we not engage with it? Mm-hmm. And maybe one picture that I can give is I was out there, I think last week, in my garden, and I was just dealing with symptoms from some chronic conditions I have, and I was just, it was after the sun had gone down, and I was thankful to just be in a place where the beating of my heart and my physical symptoms just didn't seem as loud. And I was looking around at the garden, and the solar light started coming around on around me, and I didn't want to go back in the house. I love my family. They were back in the house, but I didn't want to go back into the house, into where so many thoughts have run a trench, you know, and I've spiraled sometimes in my thoughts, and where just things would seem a little bit more cloistered. And on that spot, though, I started thinking about the exiles to Babylon and how God told them, he tells them, you're going to be in Babylon for 70 years. But this is the faithful remnant. These are the people who are intent on worshiping the Lord. And when they go, he says to them, build houses and live in them, make gardens and eat their produce. And when I read that again recently, I was thinking, this is God saying to them, when you are there, you are not outside my will. You are not outside my plan or my joy for you. Mm-hmm. So engage in the work that I've given you. Make the most of the time that you are given, because when you are called back, you will be called home. Mm-hmm. And that just, I wasn't thinking all of that in that one wave while I was standing there, but I was thinking I didn't want to go back in the house, and it felt to me that God, through that passage, was reminding me, but I will be there too. And I think that is the purpose of having this garden and of tending the work that he's given us to tend, is that when you tend a garden and you come back into the house, you bring some of that with you. You bring what you have learned, what has been cultivated in your soul, and the whole practice of gardening altogether, that's not just going to stay in that arena, but it peters out and it enriches you and teaches you something, and not even just teaches you something, but it grows you.
Oh yeah, so. That was the other thing I wanted to touch on when talking that I thought of, was like, gardening is certainly an act of sanctification, right? It's certainly an act of growing and learning and all that you were just talking about. But I think we also tend to forget that a lot of our talents and a lot of our endeavors and labors will also be used in the city of God. You know, we're not just living a temporary life here, and then there's going to be a completely new life in the city of God where we're, you know,
harps and wings.
Well, that. But you know, there's also a sense in where who we are now as people, as image bearers, are very unique, and we have unique talents, and we are going to bring them into the city of God. Our bodies will be resurrected. Again, as I was just in the breakout with Jane, and she's like, it's a mystery. We don't know how our bodies will be resurrected. But we know we, as a part of our bodies, we will be resurrected. Our memories will be there. The way we've grown with Christ and sanctification that we've had will be a part of us in the city of God. And if gardening is sanctifying, then that will be a part of us in the city of God as well. And I think so learning some of these ways of looking at gardening as tending to creation, learning how to subcreate, learning how to steward and cultivate and guard. One of my favorite terms for cultivate, the old term, is to guard, right? So you think about guarding as, you know, you tend a space, you guard it from intruders or predators or weeds or internal, like soil, like just, you know, bugs that eat from the bottom up. There's something about that, I think, that we take into eternity with us. And so I think that's another answer to why garden now, if it's temporary. I think that's partly why. I think it's partly why. Yeah, so many answers to that, but that's one of them.
Well, you and I were both just in the session on gender and dragon slaying, and it's interesting for going back to your Babylonian exile example. I mean, that's the story of our time in Colorado Springs. Mm. We moved here 12 years ago and spent a couple of years complaining about the fact that we were here. And took us a while to realize we weren't going anywhere anytime soon. And that given this fact, our attitudes were particularly unhelpful. But we couldn't just flip a switch and go, oh, I love this place. And we love it now. It's more, frankly, more worth loving now than it was a decade ago. But we prayed for a change of heart. And one of the things that we did in the course of that change of heart was to start putting down roots, was to start planting. We made a choice. And
figuratively speaking.
Yeah. And one of those choices was to join a smaller church where we could do some good and talk to its priest, whose name was Matt Burnett. And the result of that conversation was the Anselm Society. And the difference between us wishing we were somewhere else and saying, when we're somewhere else, when we have community,
yeah.
when we...
Yeah.
Have a beautiful home, when we then I will garden, then I will have really nice dinner parties and entertain well, then I will do this, mm-hmm. do that. And it was when we made that choice to start planting that everything that has been born through Anselm and the relationships around it, I mean, it all came from that decision. The fact that we even know you.
I love that. Didn't you write a piece about that for Cultivating, about planting a flag?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
So the Anselm Society is like your garden in exile.
At least, yeah, it was to begin with anyway. Mm-hmm. And it became a home for a lot of people, including us. There's, it also strikes me, I mentioned the gender thing, and I promise I'll get back to it. The experiencing this, I didn't have the background in gardening that you grew up with. I did a little bit of it as a kid. But it's been interesting as a man going through this experience. I don't see gardening as an essentially feminine endeavor, but there has been a beautiful maleness and femaleness to our experience
yes.
of it that I hear mirrored in your experience
yeah.
with young one, actually.
Yes.
Because the role that your husband and I played in the gardens
yeah.
Was first and foremost the role of creating the conditions in which life
yeah,
can thrive.
Providing the framework.
It is a role of framework, of structure, of protection, of provision. And then, but it was the pair of you that stepped in and gave birth to that life.
Mm.
We didn't do that part. I mean, I did whatever you told me to do. But, but it's been interesting watching that.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting watching our kids experience kind of both ends of that and realizing there are two pieces to that.
Yeah. And it's not yeah. to say that men can't.
Plant
can't.
Seeds?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
That's exactly
the, oh
well,
my
I
gosh.
Mean,
the
well,
process
just
of digging a little hole and putting something in it, I don't know.
But I have noticed like a general, like, yes, somewhat of a division of labor. I mean, my husband would say what you just said, that I just do what she tells me to do. But
which
really,
is a self-deprecating
when I
thing, but
it is,
which we shouldn't do, frankly.
But when I look at him out there, drilling holes in the posts for the hail cloth and digging the trenches, I mean, we're out there helping him. We've got pictures of the kids digging, you know, their own little way. For the sprinkler line, but he was the one out there to finish it, you know, when the weather got cold and we were indoors and we were done.
Mm-hmm.
Like he went and he finished the terracing of the wall, which is our most recent project, mm-hmm. which I fought for many years, by the way. I said, it's a sloped yard, but it'll be fine. Terracing is gonna be so much hard work, and lo and behold, here we are. And so a garden still has lots of things that it wants to teach you, I think.
I know.
I think that's part of cultivation too, like holding things loosely and discovering what the thing that is in your care needs to become.
Oh yeah, it's
a rather
humility.
Than
yeah.
you just imposing a design upon it,
like parenting.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many parallels.
Then you will be. Oh, you are not.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway, going back to that whole thing, it's been kind of beautiful to see.
Talk more about that.
But,
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just gonna say, in echo to the gender thing too, I just want to express like there's a way in which gardening in that, well, I guess you didn't really say in a feminine way, but kind of like that can be really wonderful for men too and for young boys. I have seen my son, he's always had a more of a tender heart, but I have seen him take to gardening and take to an understanding of good and evil and how he wants to protect his little plants that he has so generously nurtured into a way that helps him understand God. And he was the one who cried when the seeds died. You know, he was the one who was really upset. He's even said things to me like, that was Satan, right, Mama? Satan killed those plants. I was like, you know, in a way, that's actually true. Like, in a weird way. Like, he's learning about the forces of good and evil, how evil does want to crush all that is good, and that it is our job to prevent that, right? It is our job to say, no, Satan, no death. Like, we will defeat this part that you are trying to play. So, and of course, there's lots of, you know, theological implications. Like, well I was even asking this question this year, like, right? Did God create life in a cycle of resurrection and death? Did the plants and seeds always die, right? Or did Adam and Eve's curse come over the entire world and create a cycle of life and death in seeds and living things? So that's another whole thing that could be addressed. But I think in a way, my son's innocent question was a very deep understanding of what can come through gardening and understanding that there are things we cannot prevent and there are things we can fight against.
Picking up on that, and also on the last thing that you said, Amy, that idea of holding a gift loosely. Talk about what it has looked like for you as a gardener. How has that process of becoming a gardener, in the literal sense, helped you to become more of a gardener in God's story? I don't mean to be too literal. That sounds almost corny the way I'm asking it, but I know it's happened, so I ask.
Oh, yeah. You gonna go for that?
Yeah. Yes.
I just went for the big one.
It has changed me in terms of relating to other areas of art, too. If you've ever read Bandersnatch, Diana Glyer talks about C.S. Lewis beginning with the poem Dimer and then realizing, I don't know if it was Dimer actually, he had an idea in mind, he wrote it out as a great long poem, and then he realized it's not working as a poem. It needs to come, and he took it back down to studs. And when I was thinking about how we had to move, shift things in the garden, and even the terracing has been a great alteration to some extent, it takes a certain willingness to do that, and God bless my husband for being willing to do that, because he could have just said, nope, we're just going to grow, you know, whatever will grow. But we've restructured and moved things around, and I think with writing, I fight that a lot more, killing my darlings and rolling things back to a first draft and saying, okay, what does it actually need to be? How do I serve the reader? And so it has kind of developed me in that area. And I think probably the biggest function for me has been, it's been a place of healing for me. Can I go into that?
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. So the garden for us has been a place to come to terms with hard things. I mean, one of the things that you get to observe in a garden is, oh, we've had so much wildlife come through the garden, but there are things that die. There are caterpillars that are caught in the first frost. There are birds that come through that you later see on the curb on the street in a flurry of feathers and all sorts of things. But back in 2016, I had a mental breakdown of anxiety that had been building through many years, and it was exacerbated by trauma along the way, but 2016 is really when it came to a head, and I couldn't function very well. I had to sing hymns to be able to regulate my breathing. I had to come up with creative ways to deal in the aftermath and kind of find my way back to being human again. But the garden was where, it's kind of funny for me to look back on the timeline now and realize what we were doing every year with the garden, because they're kind of separate timelines in my head. I realize how long it took for certain phases of healing and recovery from the breakdown. And I also, but I know that we were doing work on the garden at the same time, and it just doesn't, it doesn't occur at the same time in my mind. But I think part of the reason is that, you know, getting out there and digging, and still, like, I still have a problem. I can't crouch down and bend over too often, because I'll feel it in my heart rhythm. But just sitting out there and learning to look at things and learning to sit, and I think there's a lovely word, citharism, which is the word for the sound of the wind blowing through the leaves of trees. Citharism, and it's got a silent P at the beginning. It's an archaic word, and I love it when I stumble on things that Google tells me is an archaic word, because I'm like, yes, I'm bringing it back. But just listening, it sounds like a sea swell, you know, the wind coming up through, especially through aspen leaves, I think. So we have aspen, we had three aspen in the neighbor's yard, kind of overarching into ours, but listening to that and learning to be still. The garden was the first place where I started to come to terms with what does the presence of beauty have to do with my relationship to God. And it was when I was reading lots of things and thinking about them, but I looked out on the garden one day. We have a little bay window that looks out on the garden. And I was just thinking, you know, like a robin came by and it caught the light somehow in a way that really just gilded its wings. And I remember thinking that was put there for me. There's nobody else watching that. It happened and I saw it. Can I take that as a personal thing from God? Did he place that for me? And that's one of the things that I love about Clyde Kilby, who was a professor at Wheaton. Apparently he would walk into his classroom and say, look at this dandelion. And the students would be like, okay. But he would say, look at this dandelion. God made this dandelion this day, you know, to grow up this day for your pleasure. And apparently that was the way that he approached life, and he just had this stance of delight and wonder. And I think that was really the beginning of my recovery, to understand that beauty in the garden and the kind of grace that comes as you watch things grow without your help and are in their natural processes, to witness that year after year and to see just, I mean, 20 apple snapdragons, I think is what they're called. They're new in our garden this year. And sugar star phlox, and just the sheer, how can that much color burst from a thing that looks like a fist at the beginning of spring? Just to watch that and to understand, I can take beauty as a personal, intimate communication from God. I think that helped me to learn how to look for him in the day by day, because I knew the gospel story, and I knew who had walked with me all these years. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to watch for him in every day, because the anxious thoughts are always there. What's the truth that's there, the minute-by-minute truth that's there to fight them back? And to this day, it is still, what am I seeing in front of my eyes? What is he showing me right now that reminds me of the kind of God that he is, whose divine power and eternal nature, and or I might have switched those two, are displayed in nature. And so for me, I think that's really how the garden has shaped me as a person, as a follower of Christ.
I mentioned my mom's death about a year ago. And the fact that it coincided with getting my very first plot of land to call my own. I still remember in one of the phases of my gardening this past summer, it was late at night, it had been a rough day. I don't say late at night, it was late in the dusk, so it was like very dusky outside. It's a gorgeous time of night, there was crickets, the kids were in bed, Brian was gone somewhere, and I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out, walk in the garden, and yell at God. And I didn't like purposely think, I'm just going to go yell at God, but I did. I was kind of like, I need to have a conversation with God, and I need to have it in my garden. Mm-hmm. I need to do it here. I need to do it where I have like sweated and worked and labored. And seen success and failure and, you know, resurrection and death. And, you know, I need to really ask those questions of God. Why death? Why my mom? She's 58. Why? You know, she has a 16-year-old at home. Why? She can never see her grandkids. Why? Why death? Do I believe in the resurrection? And I think having that question, you know, in the middle of a garden, in the middle of a place that proves the resurrection and the life and the beauty and the power even of God. And in the midst of the labors in the fruits of my own hands, right, through like working the ground, was very healing. It was very healing. And I think that's kind of how, I think being in nature and being in a place that you can cultivate alongside God can really give you those moments of encountering Him, asking hard questions, getting soft answers. And I will say that I think that the death of my mother and being given the gift of this house and this plot of land kind of at the same time has strengthened my faith rather than weakened it, which I feel like is a huge gift, you know. When I first got this house, it was, like I said, just a few weeks before my mom passed away, and I was like, how am I supposed to hold my dream house, right, my dream place, my dream garden, and my joy over it in the same hand as my sorrow? Like, how can you unite those? How can you? And I was like, you feel guilty over the joy that you had and were going to receive with glad hands. And this person, I still can't remember even who it was, but they said, like, this gift and this timing was not an accident. Like, you need to not feel guilty about this joy because it was given to you at this time. And a year later, I've just seen that be 100% true. And I think some of the conversations that I've had with God and the spiritual growth has been because He has given this gift at this time, this gift of sorrow and life, and how do you bring them together and how do you reconcile them, I think has been really good for me. So yeah, that's my answer.
And the beauty of it is that sometime, we'll have to have a follow-up conversation on the podcast about this sometime, the relationship between your gardens and the Arts Guild. Because I see a lot of parallels.
Woo! You opened up an entire new avenue of that.
But you both do such a beautiful job experiencing life with 50 local artists and walking through that with them and helping them to grow. Thank you both for sharing your stories and your time with us.
Thanks for asking us.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
It's been fun.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Anselm Society in Colorado Springs. Our mission is a renaissance of the Christian imagination. We exist to help Christians remember who they are, to cultivate a deep awareness of their relationship to the great story, and to bring that awareness home to their families and churches. To find out more about us or to become a patron, please visit anselmsociety.org. Thanks for listening.